Hello and welcome to episode 436 of the Crate and Crowbar, an extremely intermittent gaming podcast being resurrected on the 10th of September in the year of 2024. I'm a stinking sack of bones, formerly known as Marsh Davis. I'm joined tonight by the ectoplasmic entity that answers balefully to the name Jamie Britton.
Hello.
And a series of canopic jars containing the shriveled organs and final echoing sneeze of one Chris Thurston.
Hiss.
was that an echoing sneeze? or just one of your organs giving off?
I just decided to be an asp.
Huh?
And you, and you can't tell me not to.
Thematically appropriate asp. We've been away, guys, haven't we? And we're very sorry. We're very sorry about that.
But we're really sorry, but somehow Crate and Crowbar has returned.
the sheer power of guilt and friendship compels us once again to do this.
we've had our reasons for being away. For example, congratulations on birthing another novel, Chris Thurston.
It's all noises from me, thank you.
What's it called and what's it about?
So my first book is called Dark Oath, a Gunnarbrand novel. It's a Warhammer Age of Sigmar dark fantasy story, sort of post-apocalyptic, Conan-esque adventures about a big Viking with anxiety. Sorry, I can't not play it down because we have a big radical change for the podcast. We're using webcams to see each other's faces, and I'm just watching Marsh gaze very seriously into the upper left of his monitor, which is where I assume I am, and it's freaking out my gourd. But yes, I wrote a book last year. It's out now. Seems to have gone down quite well, which is lovely. It's very strange. It's a very quick way to go completely mad, I found, having a book out, because most of the forms of any kind of entertainment I've ever made in my life I've received quite quickly by people, and they let you know if they fucking hate it almost immediately, whether that's games journalism or theater or comedy or something like that. I have had to internalize the fact that people will go and buy a book and look at the book and go, I'm really glad I own this, and put it on a shelf and never interact with it ever again. And therefore...
That's certainly what I do with most of my books, I would
right,
say.
Me too.
75% of my books.
And so the validation that I crave, obviously I wouldn't do any of this if I didn't, is withheld to sort of scattershot comments and Reddit threads and Goodreads reviews and things. And it's just a very quick way to go completely mad, which is why I've written two more as yet unannounced. Can't really talk about them because I'm under NDA. But yeah, I've written two this year, which is part of why I've been away.
Good. Thank you,
Jamie.
Thank you for explaining yourself.
You've been busy at Maverick Studios. Are you any closer to disclosing the terrible things that you have done behind the doors there?
Well, I have been doing that, but the real reason I've been away is that I've been facing some of the trauma I experienced as a child when my parents were gunned down in front of me after a theatre trip. And I'm not going to go into details about what I've been doing, but it does involve costumes and fascism. So... that has been consuming my nights. In the days, I have mostly been working, at Maverick Games, up in Warwick, from where I am calling now, from one of my favourite weird hotels, pictured behind me for the benefit of the guys on the recording. We've released a little bit of information about the game now. We're being published by Amazon, and we are making a AAA open world narrative driven driving game, which is lots of words, which is not surprising considering the team is largely made up of people who previously worked on the Forza Horizon games. That's what I've been doing. It's been a hell of a roller coaster. Games, it turned out, are quite complicated things to make, but I'm having a blast doing it. But yes, it has been somewhat all consuming, that as well as my vigilante activities at night. It's hard to juggle both.
I'm just impressed you can juggle games development and being a Labour frontbencher, which is, I assume, what you were alluding to.
Of course.
Marsh, how's your life?
It's okay. It's busy at the moment because we've been prepping for a new Kickstarter of a new tabletop role-playing game, which you're talking about delayed gratification for your books, but like there is at least like a year delay before somebody gets around to playing like a tabletop role-playing game. So it's, you know, we launched the last game into, you know, people were pleased with it, but people did not play it for a long period of time. And they're just starting to sort of trickle in with people's experiences of the game rather than it has a book, which has been gratifying. And now we're just about to launch the next one, which is a nautical themed adventure set in a cursed corner of the Caribbean. Yeah, we'll see how mediocre the sales are for that on Monday.
It's another classic object to own, be happy you own, but never look at or provide any feedback on, isn't it? An RPG. Yeah. I think that's another. Maybe it does fall under the broader category of book, but nonetheless, another. I've got lots behind me on my shelf here that I have not played. So,
have you done some of your lovely drawings for this one, Mush?
I have, yes. All kinds of drawings so far. People with big sea louses consuming their tongues. Anemones and seaweed growing out of eyeballs, that kind of stuff, you know. Pies, all the good things.
Pies. Well, it sounds fantastic. I cannot wait to back it thoroughly and completely. Not
thank you.
I'm not made of money, but I will.
Robustly and absolutely.
Well, it's good to know you're fronting the entire cost of printing, Jamie. That's very generous of you.
That's right. So, yes, we have been away for a while due to reasons just explained, as well as the fact that I think, as we've discussed in the past a little bit, it's our relationships with games have changed somewhat, being as like, you know, a couple of us are making them, all of us are making them on one way or another, and just kind of, you know, as your life changes and people come and go, you end up kind of doing different stuff. So, that said, I think after a couple of chats about this, we're very eager to get the podcast kind of back on track and back in your ears. As a fan of this podcast, sort of first, I've gone through the fan to host pipeline. Mm-hmm. You know, I know, you know, what this podcast means to people, and I think we're all eager to kind of keep it going. With a few changes made, I think, to make it a little bit more producible and hopefully a little bit more frequent, if that makes sense.
More frequent than every 4 months? Stop.
We're going to make it somewhat more frequent than 4 months. So the way it's going to be, I sound a bit Ray Winston there. Ray Winston in words and Kenneth Williams in voice. The way it's going to be is we're going to be releasing every other week rather than every week, which will give us a bit more time to sort of prepare and play the games and do all the editing and things like that. And we're also going to focus back in on games primarily, rather than doing our kind of lock-in type things on movies and films and TV and stuff, although that was fun. I think in order to make this, again, a bit more producible, a bit more frequent, we're going to focus back in on games. And we're also going to announce the games that we're going to cover in advance, either on our Discord or on our socials, so that you, the listener, can play along if you so wish. And we can sort of chat about it, because I think a big appeal for me as a fan of the podcast and just the podcast in general is we've got this absolutely lovely Discord community, which is honestly one of the best places to hang out on the internet, I find. Just so many absolutely lovely people in there. And so, yeah, I think it would be great if we can involve that community a little bit more, whether it's through kind of playing along with the game, but also we're going to resurrect questions from questions as well. And we'll give out the info for how you can submit to that there. Is that everything, lads? Have I covered it all?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we've given 2 weeks cadence a go before, but we mean it this time. we've discovered a radical idea, which is that you can actually, if something is every 2 weeks, you know what date it happens on. Having unlocked that hidden knowledge of how calendars work, we've gained greater confidence in being able to, you know, wrestle up a pod crew. So, yeah, I feel good about it. I'm excited to be back on this particular horse.
I think it's also worth saying that various people have kind of somewhat moved on from the pods in recent years. So I think the crew is mostly going to be the three of us here, mm-hmm. With possible Tom Senior popping on as well.
Yeah.
And the OG crew and everyone who's been on the pod before is more than welcome to join us should they please, but they don't have to. We can't make them.
Evidently.
So yeah, hopefully that's everything. Oh, I did want to actually just kind of, speaking of the Discord, I did just want to sort of shout out our Discord once again, and also our excellent mods, Jammy, the Immortal Kane, Takuna, Viserif, and I don't know how to pronounce Fienya.
Fienya from Discord, famously.
Fienya. I just wanted to shout them out at the top because they are lovely and they've been running the Discord brilliantly for years now, basically without a hitch, and do an excellent job. So yeah, I just wanted to single them out as well.
I'm glad you're here, Jamie, to be so wholesome and think to do that, because we've been doing this for more than a decade and we've never done that before. Indeed. Thank goodness you're here.
Ooh, that sounds and smells like a segue.
Oh, zipping past.
Oh, okay.
Maybe it wasn't.
Apparently driving off with very a further word. Goodbye, segue. Farewell.
I tried, all right? Someone else kick off. Thank goodness you're here. My brain has died.
So thank goodness you're here. We've said it a lot of times now. Thank goodness you're here. Then there was one more. Thank goodness you're here. Three times. Thank goodness you're here. It's a game developed by Cold Supper, which released earlier this year, beginning of August. And it is, I think you could best describe it as a comedy platformer walking sim type game.
Point and click, maybe throw that in there as well. Why not?
Why not? I mean, yeah, I guess so.
Is it a match three? It could be. It isn't.
It isn't a match three. That's the one thing it isn't.
It is briefly a rhythm action game, though.
It's true.
In its triumphant climactic sequence.
Absolutely. But in it, you play as a, I think best described as a little fella.
I've just written Marsh on my...
Marsh.
I don't. What? I'm not nowhere near that helpful to people.
No. Yeah. It's a
jaundiced. Yes. Helpful. No.
It took some liberties with this biopic, but I believe it absolutely.
So yeah, you play as Marsh Davies, you play as a journalist who is dispatched to the town of Barnsworth. I can't even remember if there's actually a reason. they just say that like there's something going on in that town and you should go and check it out.
Aren't you a tiny little salesman?
You're a regional salesman, I believe. And the people of Barnsworth need your produce, whatever that might be.
That's true, yeah. So you go for a meeting with the mayor, who keeps you waiting. And so instead of waiting there, you head off into the town of Barnsworth to go on a little adventure. Mostly involving meat products, which is the kind of, you know, the sort of totem pole of which the totem sausage around which the game sort of prances and dances.
Yes, it's sort of you're sort of fixing a series of local calamities, largely by accident, because the only verb in the game. Oh, I suppose you can jump occasionally, but like mostly your interaction with things is to slap them, which doesn't give you wouldn't think a broad range of expression, but actually the results of your slaps are wide and varied. And I suppose it's not really much more than a gag machine where you sort of advance through the sort of these various comic vignettes by slapping things, and you slap the one thing in the scene which allows you to advance. I don't really think that's bad. Like, I think it doesn't need to be anything more than that because the comic vignettes are so successful to me anyway, or at least, you know, grotesque in a way which I find intensely pleasurable.
I think that's to clarify my own statement. The reason that I sort of internalized this as a game, not about you, Marsh, but for you. I really felt it while I was playing it. I think the thing, because you really play, you're kind of accidentally helpful, and your only verb is to slap. And a lot of one of the game's great sources of humor is you can't do anything else. Not in a way that feels like it's restricting your agency, but in a way that feels like you're playing along. it's very funny that that's your only real way to interact with people, regardless of their emotional state or state of peril or whatever, is just to give them a big old slap on the bum or whatever.
Yeah,
your adventure.
And the fact that, like, the game has pivoted itself around that. So basically, this game takes place in a world where being slapped is okay. Like, it's not preferable or...
The North, yes.
It's just the North, right? So, like, people will generally just respond to you quite happily with a slap.
There's also a thing that I wish all role-playing games would adopt, which is when you've exhausted someone's supply of unique dialogue when you slap them, they just start going, "Ugh!" And that,
yeah.
And then you know that it's safe to move on. But yeah, I think, like, because who you really are in it, and I think this is the key to its appeal to me, is, like, this little... Or yes, you're a kind of roaming little salesman or handyman type figure, but you're also this sort of strange little kind of spirit of pure id or chaos that kind of comes in and somehow kind of straightens everything out. And I realized something while I was putting together this, because its great strength is obviously it's very, very funny and it can be very surreal. And I realized that this is going to sound like a strange statement. I'd be interested to know if you know what I mean by it. The protagonist, whoever you are, works according to Mario logic, which is Mario can be basically fucking anything, right? He can be, you know, he can kind of change size to suit whatever the designers of a given Mario game believe will be the most fun. He can become a little raccoon. He can wear a hat and spit fireballs. He can, you know, transform and change. And there's a sort of surrealism in service of, like, childlike delight in Mario that in this is sort of becomes surrealism in service of dick jokes and slapstick, which I think is a nobler calling, to be honest, and like a light layer of like social awareness as well, which is really sort of charming. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it totally does. I think the fact that it's got like a strong like kind of like vein of like body horror sort of moving through it as well, that works quite well too, that like Mario kind of has that too in a funny way, and more recent Marios have kind of leaned into that a little bit more actually, but this game like goes, it's got lots of kind of distended limbs and fatty products. There's at one point there's like a pork, what can only be described as a pork Akira, which is kind of great. And there is a kind of morphology to it that is kind of, it's very British, actually. It's very kind of British comedy, I think. And that kind of puts it in a really, like, unusual lineage, I think. In that, like, in, like, British comedy, I think you can sort of divide it into just, like, in a kind of, this is sort of kind of very crude way of doing it. But there's, like, posh people comedy, right, which is, like, Monty Python and people from Oxbridge singing satirical songs at the Edinburgh Fringe, right? That's one. That's 50% of comedy. I'm
strangely attacked by this.
and then there is the kind of other kind of strain of comedy, which is like, and it's, I hate just saying the term working class in the voice I have, right? Because it sounds just patronizing and awful, but kind of more working class comedy, which kind of has its basis in sort of music hall pre-war kind of culture, and then is kind of fed through to the modern day with kind of various kind of silly comedy, like Billy Connolly would be part of this, Jasper Carrot would be part of this, some of those early alternative comedians, and much more into the modern day with like Viz Magazine, Vic and Bob, Mark and Lard on the radio in the 90s, you know. And it is a comedy that is basically all based around how shit Britain is. Like, the posh comedy will be obsessed with class and authority figures and all that kind of stuff and sort of society and that kind of vibe. Whereas this other form of comedy is generally a lot about meat pies and rubbish bags and kind of the shitness and hilarity of kind of everyday life. And I thought, thank goodness you're here, like really comfortably kind of sits in that kind of lineage of funny, silly, British kind of working class comedy, as opposed to kind of something that's kind of high cultural and quippy and witty, even though this game is all of those things.
Yeah, I wonder, where do you think its sort of sense of grotesqueness falls? Do you think, how kind is it being to its targets? Like, there were a few scenes in it where I thought were perhaps less than generous towards the people being depicted in them. On the whole, I thought it was quite an affectionate portrait of a completely benighted place. But there's a scene in the fish and chip shop where it's just sort of like a rose gallery of the most debased forms of humanity.
That's got one of my favorite jokes in the game there, where the woman says, "I'm eating for two here, and I'm pregnant."
Yeah.
Which is just great.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I really agree with, like, the Vic and Bob comparison particularly. I do think there's quite a lot of Terry Gilliam in it, to, like, not to kind of drag Python back in, but I do think it's got a bit of that same absurdity. And, like, again, you know, that sort of... I think you're right that it sort of maybe evades the most kind of footlightsy Oxford Review-y parts of that era of comedy, but I think it does inherit a big chunk of the pure weirdness.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of jam in it, isn't there?
Yeah, there's quite a lot of jam.
Jam and Royston Vasey as well.
Yeah.
Also Oxbridge people, but writing about... northern towns.
Well, this is the thing, like, the best comedy is when those forces meet. Because, right. Like, Monty Python is essentially posh people taking on the sillier, lower comedy of a Spike Milligan, right? So it's kind of and League of Gentlemen as well, like, has that kind of macabre sense of silliness with that kind of intellectual rigor behind it. So I think, like, there's a way of looking at it as its kind of cultural kind of collaboration that you get these kind of nice vibes with. But yeah, I think it's I think what's also lovely about it is that it's just very much, like, it's clearly what the guys behind it think is really funny. It's clearly made to make them laugh. And some of the jokes in it, some of my favorite jokes in it, are the ones that don't really have punchlines and don't even, like, necessarily have a premise. Like, it's just the funny way that this worm talks to you. Which is just, and it just sort of leaves you with a kind of sense of, you know, like, kind of vacancy, as it kind of, you're like, well, what the hell was that? And then you just have to kind of continue on with your day. And there's something very confident about jokes like that, I think. Like, you have to be really sure of yourself to kind of include jokes that don't really have a punchline. They just have a kind of, you know, vibe to them that works.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. It's a really interesting mix of, and probably, I mean, as a funny game, and that's probably the broader subject we could link it into in terms of its, you know, other equivalently genuinely funny games. It has a really admirable joke density, which not all games achieve, right? Like, it's you know, it's very, you can hardly slap anything in that game without it being funny. And that's, you know, and that's really to its enormous credit, because really you're doing these sort of loops of various kind of kinds around different parts of this town and back again and finding new routes back to the same places and so on. And it uses, I think the thing that's so clever about it and genuinely really accomplished is, even though it's got a really high joke density, and even though it's kind of has the confidence, as you say, to have some of those jokes kind of just be odd little asides and so on, just to kind of keep you amused, it kind of operates these both, like, big kind of joke cycles and smaller ones within them, and the sort of jokes within jokes that are all kind of rotating at different frequencies. So almost every, you know, if you think about something kind of trite, like, you know, rule of threes or something like that, almost everything in the game plays itself out at least three times at one scale or another, even within a scene. And so you're getting callbacks almost constantly, and then get those, like, moments of delight when the solution to a small thing happens to kind of land at the same beat as the escalation of one of those bigger things, and they start looping back together. And as you said, Marsh, it kind of plays all of those things through really spectacularly into the ending. Like, it's both, it has this really interesting quality of feeling both quite, like, loose and every idea anyone had made it in, and, like, really quite tightly engineered to kind of consistently reward those repetitions and build anticipation. Like, I think I said this last week when we were talking about it on the podcast, but my favorite joke in it is, I guess minor spoilers, but I guess, you know, people play for things like this, is there's a pipe you have to go through one way. It's a one-way pipe, and you will pass through it multiple times in the course of the game. The first time you pass through it, you go under, you can see through, like, a cross-section view, that you're going underneath someone's living room, causing their floor to buck And as it bucks this armoire, and a Princess Diana memorial plate moves like an inch to the right. And the moment that happens twice, you know you're going to have to go through that pipe exactly enough times to knock the Princess Diana memorial pipe off the armoire. And even though it's telegraphed so far in advance, every time that became funnier to me, that like they keep doing the same bit and finding these incredibly convoluted ways through other jokes to get you back to the start of that pipe to kind of like go, oh, here we go again. And yeah, like it's those so many different like nested bits of like anticipation and payoff within each other that I think makes it so clever, because there's... that takes an enormous amount of planning. And it feels like that kind of greater superstructure is then also like watered with all of these just like one-off gags, like the owl who pops up in a tree, says a non sequitur and goes away again, or the singing rats or any of those other ones.
I'd love to see the flow diagram of the game, because I wasn't sure, because it feels at times that there are more options available to you than a single exit. But I'm not sure that's the case, but it's so tightly controlled in how it loops you back around and around and around, and how it apportions out the jokes for each particular visit. It must be very expertly created, sort of Dark Souls-esque. The Dark Souls of the smacky bum-bum joke.
It really is. Yeah, like there's little bits like, because it wants to funnel you different areas, it has different fun ways of blocking different parts of the town to force you down a particular route. And one of them is just a learner driver that gets stuck at one point or another in every single alleyway in the town. And that's, you know, it's there's so much sort of effort gone into kind of almost tracking the movement of the characters that you're not controlling, so that there are little micro stories that play out in and around everything else as well. It's really very well done.
Because it's a huge, it's not a huge game, right? But it must have taken a huge amount of effort to make it. Like all of these lovely little bespoke animations for everything, and like they make a virtue out of their scale. Like they build that scale into the game to allow these kind of those jokes, those rule of three jokes, and they make the loop a pleasure for the most part. You never think, oh no, this again, because there's always a really excellent kind of twist on the gag as you move through, and the way that they will like, you know, sort of diversify the spaces and kind of bring in new characters, or you always want to go up to someone and slap. You always want to go and slap the guy who's selling the oily baps to see if he's got something else to say about oily baps. One of my favorite, I was talking to you about this last week too. I think my favorite joke in it is like a weird ambient joke. I mean, the game just has some of the best sign gags, I think, in any game, maybe. Like the fact that everything costs 10 bob, like literally everything in the game costs 10 bob. There's one where there's a sign that says polite notice, hello, which I thought was very good. Really good. There's just loads and loads of stuff like that. One of my favorite gags is that there is a memorial tree in the first area you go to, which says Bobby Ob Jobs, never forget. Right, which is funny in and of itself that there was a local character called Bobby Ob Jobs who needs to not be forgotten, but also like on replaying that area, realizing that the reason that Bobby Ob Jobs is so fondly remembered is because the town is in desperate need of someone to do odd jobs, which is what you spend the game doing, right? And I just like, I appreciate that level of depth to it as well. Like there is a level of depth and kind of complexity to it, as well as putting fags in fish's mouths in the fishmonger, that is just just really funny.
Yeah, I think the man who just kicks a bike outside the pub for no reason is my favorite gag that doesn't go anywhere in the whole game. Except at the end, his doctor tells him to stop kicking the bike, and he has stopped.
The sign outside the pub says, "Today's special, drinks."
And, you know, big... I mean, obviously, the other side to it that I think we should probably mention is the voice acting, which is tremendous. Terrific. Throughout. Yeah, really, really good. Genuine pleasure to hear. I haven't seen Log in years, but, you know, I guess we could say friend of pod, because we all, I think, knew John at some point. Another John Blythe of regular features fame as... just a big pie salesman
Big Ron's big pies.
I say that to myself all the time now. And the running gag about, like, I don't know, the scene of like you know, the boy that's actually from a small pie, a big pie household. Whose girlfriend's dad is a small pie man.
Yeah, he's got a sticker on his window saying proud small pie household or something like that. And then they have a terrible faux pas moment at dinner when he says, well, normally you just have the pie would be big enough not to serve anything with it. And everyone gets quiet. Generally, I mean, it's love. I wrote for John's website back in the very, very early noughties and kind of occasionally went and had some drinks with that lot. And Log's genuine, like, warmth and being one of the funniest people I think who maybe have ever lived on Earth, it just sort of shines through his performance in that. And Matt Berry as well is kind of great as well. He's a great catch for them. It's good to hear him doing a kind of different voice than his sort of standard one. And just, I think a lot of the voices are just them, right? The developers doing silly voices. And it's just, they're just, every single one of them makes a choice. And I just really appreciate that. There's so much dialogue in games where no one's made any kind of choices at all. And everyone's just sort of, you know, grunting and barking in the standard way. Whereas this game has grunts and barks of all kind of manner and variety, you know.
I do wonder, I was just playing it through, I do wonder how well it has landed outside the UK. I'm not saying that I think a lot of its jokes will carry, but it's also quite unusual in that it does feel very grounded in, like, not just British comedy, but the north of England specifically. And so, you know, and like the use of real archive footage of, like, you know, terraced houses in mine in pit towns on its menu screens and so on feels very evocative, but very specific as well.
And the song Ilklymore by Tats, which must be very perplexing. I mean, it's perplexing to people from the Northwest like me, but I think quite a few people I work with are from other countries. And actually the response from, like, a guy I work with who's Hungarian, he was like, I didn't get a whole bunch of the cultural references, but in a way that made it kind of funnier because you're sort of, it's so perplexing. It kind of goes out of its way to be stupid that you don't really know what the line is between, like, this is referencing something or this is just like a stupid novel. So I think it works quite well. There's enough sort of space in there to enjoy yourself, even if you don't quite, even if you've never been to Morecambe.
Right. There's also, I mean, there is a lot of, like, genuine pathos in it as well. I think that's the other thing. You know, when you made the point earlier about, like, not always being 100% sure if it's kind of who it's making fun of or where it's kind of comedy is. But I think there are the occasional jokes that maybe are at the expense of the characters in it. But a lot of it is genuinely quite sweet as well. Like, you know.
Yeah. So I think one of my favorite parts of it, which isn't like, isn't just non-stop gags, but it's one of these sort of bits at the end of a sequence of labor that you've put in, which then rewards you with what is essentially like a 5-minute cartoon in which you have a flashback throughout the greengrocer's life to see how he's been tormented by the size of his head. And it's, you know, it just goes through being, you know, bullied as a child and then, you know, his wife leaving him because it's just too big. And this gets to a breaking point, which explains the fact that he is now smashing up his own greengrocers and throwing vegetables at people. But then, and that's very kind of tragic and funny in its own right. But then later, Big Ron is consoling him on a bench outside. He's just like, I've had a big head or two, you know, and I've done all right. And they've done all right as well. And let's go and have a pint. And it's just quite sweet, you know.
It's also the sort of like the micro interests of everyone in the town. Like, everyone has these sort of really specific kind of interests and foibles. And there aren't really any outright villains, to be honest. Like, that I can think of, unless I'm really dramatically missing something, you know, it's sort of,
I mean, you're the villain to that guy who you keep spilling dust all over his fireplace.
Oh, yeah. But, like, yes, I think that's the character that, like, kind of is pure pathos without getting any kind of revenge apart from, but even just the detail that he appears to be completely obsessed with Spitfires is like incredibly on point. Like, I think it's sort of,
I've been in rooms like that.
I mean,
to World War II aircraft.
I think he might have a book on his shelf called something like Plane Spotting for Knobheads.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've told the story on the pod before that my mum's downstairs bathroom is completely dedicated to Concorde and the Vulcan bomber, her two favorite defunct aircraft. So that being a really on point, like, kind of observation of, like, perhaps that exists in all cultures, but part of that felt really specifically like, yes, I know this person because I'm her son. to me, I think, like, yeah, it's also an interesting mix of, because it's ostensibly contemporary, right? Like, it doesn't constrain itself to a time period that I can talk. It feels sort of spiritually set in the 80s or 90s, but there are also gags involving like mobile phones and stuff like that. So it seems to sort of zip about into this sort of timeless pastiche Britain, which is anywhere between 1950 and now at any given time. A paean, if you will, to a vanished Britain of big pies and meat horror.
Sam's hams. Yeah.
Yeah. Sooty chimneys and horny gardeners. A real Britain.
Yeah, it's great. And I can't wait for what they do next. Like, I hope they can make the kind of Disco Elysium version of this. Like, where we can really kind of see a whole terrace street of Barnsworth, maybe.
Yeah, actually, yeah. Honestly, I'll go on a limb and say the most kind of complete and culturally distinct statement since Disco Elysium, but with bum jokes in it.
Absolutely. I mean, it's hard to do funny games. It's hard to do laugh out loud funny games. Like, there's not many I can think of really, that are genuinely laugh out loud funny. Like, one that comes to mind is like Time Gentleman Please and Ben There Dan That, the kind of point and click adventures that Dan Marshall made kind of way back in the day. West of Loathing, the asymmetric games, is a very, very, very funny game. But in terms of the kind of, you know, the sort of indie space, I think there's a really, there's obviously like so much like untapped talent there, because like there's been a few kind of pop-ups of this and like Untitled Goose Game, with which it shares a publisher, I think, and like, yeah, just like when a game like this drops, it's just like it feels so fresh and new, and just kind of hope for the future, I think, in that there's plenty of people around to make knob gags and pie gags and all that sort of stuff.
I do think Goose Game is a good comparison, actually. I feel like if you were to talk about what pre-existing success would give a publisher kind of confidence in backing this or publishing this, you kind of have to point to Goose Game, I think. And it's interesting to kind of think about how Goose Game itself is a sort of rarefied example of the slapstick genre. You know what I mean? The stuff that can be so cheap and kind of knockoff, or kind of at least asset store-ish, like a Goat Simulator or something like that, like a kind of pure. And I think those, you know, those games can have like a quality in that sense of scrappiness. But it's interesting that it's kind of rarefied to this point of quite kind of distinct craftsmanship to create something fundamentally the same pitch, right? Like you're a nonsense little rascal in a village, time to knock shit over, but kind of in this case to a really high density of quite clever jokes and kind of really thoughtful, kind of precise writing and so on.
Yeah, and just, you know, having spent a bit of time, you know, writing games now, or writing a game now, you know, one of the things I've learned is that, and it should have been plain to see really, is that comedy is really hard in a game, right? Because the secret of comedy is, of course, timing. And, you know, it's that is something that games, you know, you have to work very hard on how you, you know, what triggers the gag, what triggers the punchline. And it's a really tricky thing to do. And like, they have nailed it in this game kind of relentlessly.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really good example of, I think, a kind of comedy that games are good at. Because there are two ways that, you know, thinking of the game we'll talk about is funny in both ways as well. But games can simply have funny writing, right? And that can carry something like a Portal, for example. And very occasionally, a puzzle solution might kind of play into the humor somewhat. But really, it's, you know, two distinct experiences, like the puzzle solving and funny writing. And that's the more often than not the approach that's pursued, right? Like, we'll just have good gags on top of whatever the action of the game is. But then the other side of it is, and I think, thank goodness she has a really good example of this, is games are very good at making you understand systems and structures and anticipate patterns, right? Like, you know, pattern anticipation is a lot of playing most kinds of games. And that is a great vehicle for delivering like these kinds of like running jokes, as is the case in Thank Goodness You're Here. I think the thing it has the most in common with is like point and click adventures in that regard, kind of getting you to anticipate the outcome of an action through kind of showing you a lot of related interactions and then kind of paying them off in a kind of Monkey Island way or a Day of the Tentacle kind of way. But yeah, like I think it's a really good example of that sort of wit of like getting you to understand what kind of systems are at play and then getting you to anticipate what will happen in the current configuration of elements. Really good vehicle for slapstick. And I think, but you have to, I think you can't execute that without it taking over the design of the game. And I think that's what's probably like, this is a comedy first game, right? This isn't a puzzle game or a shooter or another kind of action game where a creative department has anticipated that it will work well if it's also a comedy and therefore will add gags almost in post. It has to be there from the beginning of the kind of design process for the game or it doesn't work at all. And that's probably why you don't see it as often.
Yes, it's funny because like, you know, one of my most played games over the last few years is Chivalry 2, which is also a comedy game, but a comedy game that derives its comedy from pure chaos and emergent decapitations mostly. And like, it's basically a big sandpit for kids to jump in, beat the shit out of each other, you know, which is one way to create humor, but very much the opposite of something like this, which is a much more, you know, I will say, experience.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair to Chivalry 2, as it's like the decision to give you a button you can press to scream is the key to why that game is funny.
Yeah,
like that's the systemic aspect of it, right? They could have made that just a thing that triggers when the player takes damage or triggers under certain conditions, but no, they gave you, let you press, I think it's V to just yell, and that's funny. It's a funny button to have. All games should have it, in my opinion.
If you're playing with a controller, it is literally the Y button. It's one of the face buttons on the controller. It's scream. It's kind of great.
You should scream, why?
I mean, it's maybe, you know, to the note you made, Jamie, like, I think obviously it's not an especially long game, thank goodness you're here, but that's, I think, a quality it has. Like, I think it's a game that you'd be hard-pressed to regret having spent time with. I think that's sort of, you know, I think I found it pretty kind of hard to knock in that regard. I was delighted throughout and then it ended.
Yeah, I mean, I have spent 13 quid or 14 quid or whatever it was on an indie game and then completed it in a couple of hours and like felt regret. I'm certainly not above that of being like, oh, that wasn't quite, you know, worth the money. This game though, like absolutely worth every penny, I think. Like it takes you 2 hours or a bit more than 2 hours to complete it, I think. And like, it's just clearly so much love and affection and joy has gone into it that, and you get that just shines through that, like, it's a really good value proposition, I think. Like, it's actually a really worthwhile amount of money to spend for what you get. In fact, I probably would have paid a little bit more for it, I think, because it just felt as kind of carefully conceived and delivered as like a great movie, you know, which actually, you know, a cinema ticket costs more than this video game did, and it just felt like a really nice, discreet experience that I was kind of, yeah, really happy. And I played it through twice now, and both times have been really, really funny, and I've seen stuff that I missed before, and playing through with my 8-year-old daughter, you know, which I wouldn't necessarily recommend because the game is somewhat inappropriate, but mostly not. Mostly it's just so silly. She found the flowers right at the start that are just saying, I love you, I love you, while a lawnmower slowly creeps towards her in the background. She thought she was going to die laughing, I think. So just thought it was so good. Yeah, definitely good value for money, I think, which shouldn't be a consideration, but is for some reason.
Yeah, I mean, also great. I mean, you gestured at it, but like, it is genuinely a really good spectator game as well. Like, I think it's just a fun cartoon you can put on that one of you gets to press the slap button in.
Should we talk about the second game that we were going to talk about today? The game of the year 2020, 2021, 2022, 2023, and 2024. That may be all the years it was in development. No. How many?
I think it was six or seven, maybe eight.
Okay.
I know that. I mean, I was co-working with the developer of this game in like 2017, 2018. So that should give you
wow,
a barometer. Almost
suffice to say, every year that I have played a version of this game, it has been my favorite game of that year. But it hasn't been officially because it hasn't released until this very year. And that game is Tactical Breach Wizards by none other than the podcast's very own Tom Francis.
Indeed. It'll be almost spectacularly awkward to try and discuss Tom's game on Tom's podcast, but we're going to give it a go anyway, because it's all I've been really, like, I played a lot of it in the last week. Having kind of obviously been around for various kind of tests and betas over the years, I still feel like I hadn't really sort of like, I really enjoyed it, obviously, but I was almost waiting for it to kind of, to be done with it and ready to release it in order to kind of like play it as if it were a real game and not, you know, a project that my friend was putting so much, you know, of himself into and so much time into. And it's fucking great. And I'm really pleased, both for it and for me, and for, you know, for having had a chance to now play it all the way through, and for Tom and John and the others who, John's and the others who've worked on it over the years. Because, yeah, I mean, it's like, I think the note I made here on my own notes was, it's the best game he's made, isn't it?
Yeah.
It really is.
It is.
But it was the best game he made 5 years ago. He could have just released it then.
Chris, am I right in thinking that you had a hand in the titling of this
Yeah, game? I mean, I do want to not overplay this because I was in the room. I was basically nearby. I was within earshot and able to make stupid jokes on about two occasions in the course of this game's development, which, as I understand it, isn't the same as spending 7 to 8 years actually fucking making it. So I don't want to oversell this, but I think we must have told this story before. Actually, it was at some point, I suspect in probably about 2012, 2013-ish, we were walking back from recording the PC Gamer podcast, which used to be recorded in a different building from where the main office was. And I'm not sure exactly how, but because at the time there were lots of like pretty kind of grim and serious Call of Duties and Medal of Honors coming out, and they were all starring, like, I think the Medal of Honor thing at the time was like tier one operators, which were like isolated men with big beards who lived in huts in the desert and were very good at killing people. And the publishers on one hand were stressing how realistic these games were. But the games themselves always kind of boiled down to these like incredibly kind of silly, like slow-mo breach and clear sequences. Again, while telling you how realistic it all was. And that, I don't know exactly how we got onto it, but that conversation developed into, these guys are just wizards, aren't they? Like, they're kind of isolated men with beards and specialist knowledge who can apparently slow down time and sort of, and at the time, kind of running the bit was about also the kind of incredibly arcane language of, like, you know, spec ops military folk. And so the name Tactical Breach Wizards emerged from that conversation. And truly, I don't remember whether it was me, Tom, or I think Rich McCormick, who was walking with us at the time, who said it first. But I remember really viscerally where we were when the sort of trailer kind of started to kind of play in my mind for what this game would be. And at the time, I remember really vividly, like, it was one of those bits that you kind of get caught on and riff on. And then I remember obviously it stuck around as a joke because I think it came up on the podcast a bunch of times. And then years later, Tom, I think in a DM being like, I think I'm going to make it. Does anyone mind if I make it? And obviously, enormously glad that he did. And then the other, then because I was co-working actually right as I started working in my current job back in like 2018 with John, the art director, and Tom, when we were just sort of getting out of the house, we were all working from home otherwise, I was present for a lot of conversations, which basically boiled down to like combine a boring civic job with a type of wizard to generate a funny wizard name.
Yeah.
And so there's, you know, there was a lot of fun at that particular point in time. But that is that's the disclaimer for my what I'm saying is I can have a strong opinion about this because I did fuck all, actually. But I'm grateful for the special thanks credit. Thanks, Tom.
We should probably say what kind of game it is
at some point.
It's a turn-based tactics game where your characters are, as mentioned, wizards. Fighting other wizards, other militarized wizards, non-lethally. And you have these absolutely wild set of magical powers which synergize between your various wizards in incredibly novel ways. And the game just has this immense flexibility to it where you can fulfill these special conditions on each level, which give you kind of extra requirements, like special credits, basically. And by doing so, you kind of constrain the possibility space until it becomes like a single solution puzzle game. But you can also just fuck about with the tools that it gives you however you like. And the fact that it manages to make both of those things completely permissible and equally pleasurable is a kind of wizardry. But like, because I'm always a person where I will find a way of making a game unenjoyable for myself, and having like special conditions on a game which are optional, I will nearly always do them even if I find them arduous. And they aren't arduous in this game as it happens. They're always creative and fun and. Force you to think about things in a way which sparks joy. But nonetheless, as I've gone through the game, my approach to it has developed such that I'm now looking at those optional objectives and I'm just deciding not to do some of them because I've created my own fun in seeking different objectives. Like I've developed my own set of parameters for what success feels like and how fun success should be. And I'm pursuing those instead of the optional ones sometimes. And just for the game to get me, just a perverse, joyless individual, to the point where I can actually experience pleasure again, is really remarkable. Like it's done a psychological trick on me that I don't quite understand, but it's very successful at it.
I wrote in my notes for this, neither too tight nor too loose, but just right, which sounds like a description of a pie from Thank Goodness You're Here, but yes, it also does apply to, yeah, and I think that flew, like, because I am someone who, given an optional objective, can't not do them. And I think having finished the campaign, I think I missed two in the course of it, one because I was excited right at the end, and I was excited to kind of get through to the end, and one because I just couldn't get it to trigger, and I need to go back and try it again. But I found, I really appreciate having a strong objective or a puzzle to solve in really broad systemic, like sandboxes like this. It's the same part of me, and I realized this as someone who, you know, obviously we talked about it plenty on the podcast, like all of us love a lot of the same games, but for quite different reasons. And a good example of this is games like Dishonored 2, for example, which... obviously, Tactical Breach Wizards is a very different game in terms of it being a turn-based isometric tactics game. But, you know, I would number its great kind of inheritances in terms of, like, inspiration as things like Invisible Ink, Into the Breach, and something like Dishonored 2 for the chaining of powers, basically, specifically. Like, not just Domino, the obvious one, but just generally speaking, like, the clever combination of, like, magical interventionary abilities to kind of unpick either, in that case, a stealth sandbox, in this one, more like a kind of staged combat arena. And in either context, I benefit from having like a role play thing I want to stick to. Like I was never fully capable of going like full chaos mode in Dishonored. I kind of wanted to play a character. And that would mean I wasn't just a kind of like a maniac chaining lots of powers together in a weird way. And in this, those extra kind of objectives, particularly because they're framed as like confidence objectives, so each character will feel a bit better about themselves. Because the other thing this game profoundly is five wizards getting therapy. is sort of a fun way of going like, oh, how can I kind of meet all these people's needs? It's clever, actually, now that I think about it, to kind of create a secondary objective system, which is effectively a trap for people pleasers. just to sort of, they'll feel better if you do this. But that, I think, really helped me kind of learn enough to then feel comfortable experimenting, which is a really nice balance to strike over the course of it. And I did find myself like restarting levels if I'd failed one of those conditions and so on. But that again, I think, kind of was like a pacing aid as well. Because I think one of the weaknesses of a looser sandbox, for example, is at that point, the pace can get kind of like, well, as fast as the most efficient way of solving anything. And at that point, the pace of the game as a whole can get slightly out of control. And I found that kind of sprinkling of like really interesting secondary solutions or encouragement to experiment made it feel like both pacey and really rewarding all the way through, which is a really clever trick for a puzzle game particularly.
The thing I think that's amazing about it, right, is it's the best Tom Francis simulator so far, in that, like, having listened to him talk on the podcast and played all his games, like, there are several obsessions that he has, jotting down a couple of them just while we're talking, like time, mistakes, the idea of emergence, you know, these kind of like three factors that just kind of come to mind off the top of my head, that like he's been like kicking around in both his writing and on this podcast and in his work, right? The whole kind of wibbly wobbly kind of game space where you want the players to have fun, you want the players to express themselves, and you want those moments to be meaningful, right? And I think that has been something that he has been kind of coming towards from different angles very successfully all through his kind of game making career, right? And I think the thing that Tactical Breach Wizards does better than his previous games is that it kind of it sets you up for those things really, really well. And it kind of gives you a box to play in, like literally the levels are little dioramas. And it gives you the kind of the tools, and it gives you permission to kind of set your own goals or follow the goals that you have. And for me, it just feels like I'm playing, something that really delivers on the stuff that Tom's been talking about for years and the stuff that he's been making in his games, sort of above and beyond anything he's done before, because I am someone whose brain does not work in a kind of puzzly way. I'm not, you know, tactics games are quite hard for me. I'm spatially neurodiverse. You know, these things are often hard to get on board with. But the packaging of it, narratively and also just in terms of the UI, in terms of how it's all presented to you, is just so friendly without being soft, that it's just really, really impressive. It's such a smooth experience without being slick. You know, it still has physicality, it still has a kind of sense of weight to everything you're doing, on a kind of strategic level all the way up to the UI and the sound effects and the music. We haven't even talked about the narrative yet, but it's spectacularly good, I would say. So I just think it's kind of like the game he made previously, Heat Signature, which I love and I think kind of stands pretty well amongst the kind of indie games of the last generation. But that game is like weird, right? It's a weird game. it's very hard to describe. But when you play it, it's fantastic. But it is a kind of is a game that kind of leans into the strangeness in a particular kind of way to give you a very specific experience. This game is also strange. You know, it takes place in this kind of completely bonkers world, which really shouldn't work. But actually, it all gets pulled together in such a tightly honed kind of, you know, I know Tom's been like playtesting this for years and gathering feedback, and he has that kind of open developing process, which is, you know, kind of really useful. And I do think it lands you with this, which I think is, yeah, just so successful on pretty much every count.
Yeah, maybe we should talk about the narrative, because it is, it's an astonishingly good story. And which isn't unprecedented given Tom Francis's talents, but it is nonetheless not a given for a game based on a throwaway joke about wizards, right?
I think
but I found myself really invested in the characters. I mean, it's initially very funny, and there are jokes about traffic warlocks and all these things, which are, you know, a collision of fantasy and the mundane in a way which is very amusing. But then the longer you spend with these characters, the more that I was genuinely invested in their therapy and growth and self-realization. It's what a journey.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two. One of them is a craft thing, right? Pun not intended, which is letting gags be gags, but also making characters do the majority of the lifting, both narratively and in terms of comedy, speaking of successful comedy. But the other thing, and I think it's a really, I thought this, and then I saw browsing the Steam reviews, and I saw someone point this out, which I think is a huge success for it, which is, I think all of us probably came up at a time, like, I think, you know, Marshall and I have talked about, like, Splinter Cell a whole bunch, right? Like, there are inheritances in terms of, like, military strategy games, military tactics games here that we've all kind of, series that we've really loved at various points in time because of the, either, like, the strategic excitement of it or loving stealth games or something like that. But it is really, and obviously this joke kind of depends on the slightly kind of the SWAT military Clancy-ish aspect of it. But it's also really, really kind of goes without saying that those are some pretty rancid vibes, generally speaking, like, you know, and that's not a fantasy most people want to embrace. And so kind of leaning into the, well, it's not just leaning into the wizard aspect, actually, because it's not just the humor. Like, I think Thomas done a really good job of, like, managing to tell a kind of, you know, spy story, kind of Cold War-ish kind of conspiracy drama that has good vibes, which is kind of a pretty unusual achievement. And I've seen people say that that has kind of made it accessible to them. Because, you know, the way I think about it is, you know, kicking down a door and having, you know, X number of seconds to figure out how you're going to punt everyone in that room non-lethally through a window is a very video game fantasy that in most contexts would be sort of laden with kind of, as was the origin of the joke in the first place, sort of slightly self-serious, real-world kind of connotations. And the best, maybe the best example of this is, I went to the cinema recently and there was an advert for new Call of Duty, and the advert was 50% like a man tied to a chair getting like hit with a bat, and the other 50% was like guys in multiplayer like diving through windows and shooting each other in the nuts. And it's like, that's not a great vibe. But I think Tactical Breach Wizards really does kind of make you feel like it's, you can have as much fun as you want in that world, and it's sort of maximally edifying to do so, I guess.
I'm very impressed with how confident the writing is as well. Like, and I know it shouldn't be because Tom has been a professional writer for a very long time, but this is like it's no mean feat to have a completely new kind of fictional world with quite complicated like structures and systems and bespoke little ideas within it. But also the thing that is confident is that the thing that makes it confident to me is that he's let his own like voice and sense of humor really, really shine through. So it feels really authored and really individual, while still having all the characters, you know, feel distinct as well. And that is just, that's just a really like hard thing to do. I'm so impressed that he's able to kind of deliver that, because it feels like having a conversation, that these characters are real people having conversations with each other, but it also feels authored and authored by someone as well. And I just think that's a real treat in a kind of, especially in a kind of indie game space, you don't often get that. You often have narratives which kind of often in the kind of sort of find ways to apologize for themselves in terms of how it, like often they're quite cutesy or often they're kind of quite ironic, and I think like Tom like finding a completely like unique voice for this game is something I think that really, really marks it out differently from most of what's out there, to be honest.
Looks good too, doesn't it? Old John Roberts. You can see where that length of development time went when you see just how comprehensively outfitted every single scene is with little sight gags and other things that just don't, strictly speaking, need to be there, but definitely enhance the game for being there. Like, you know, there'll just be like an ending cutscene at the end of a level or something like that, and you'll see the cat that is one of the character's companions just sauntering across a beam at the top, and you wouldn't necessarily even notice that, but there's there's obviously, having had such a long development, John Roberts has found ways of keeping himself entertained.
I haven't seen John for years, or at least I thought so, but I'm pretty sure I saw him in a central Bristol Tesco Metro the other week, but I didn't say hello because I'd just come out of a daytime screening of Deadpool versus Wolverine. I hated myself at the time. Hi, John. Good job. Yeah. So all of these things we've said are true. What's shit about it? I'll go first. There's only two train heists.
Oh. Hmm. Although there are dream sequences in which you can still recreate the same parameters as a train heist, right?
Yeah. I think. Oh, yeah, you're right. I'll say
that. There's an infinite number of those because there's so much of this game.
Yeah.
It's hard to pick another thing. I suppose maybe we could have had another three Tom Francis games out of him had he not made this. But that's about the only thing you might ding it for. I will say though that even though it's in some way embedded in the structure of the game in terms of the tools you can use and in terms of some of the optional objectives, I always feel like there is a personal sense of failure if any of my characters take damage. Mm. And obviously, one of the characters is designed around your characters taking damage because you can displace that damage to other people, and you can even kill them and resurrect them. And that is a useful and valid strategy. But I just can't allow any of my characters to take damage ever. So I suppose, is that a failing? I don't think it is. I think that's just another delightful optional objective that I have provided to myself from playing the game and enjoying its sandbox.
Yeah, I think I felt exactly the same way. It'd be interesting to see if you could track that, because I agree with you. I don't think it's a failing at all, but I think I think it is an interesting consequence of having, again, that combination of like, because if the game was interested in being pure kind of just puzzle solving, like chess puzzles, then you wouldn't have health, right? It would just be, don't get shot in this scenario, don't get shot in that scenario. So it is there as, I think, a pretty important game mechanic, so you can kind of do the maths on how to get through a particular scenario. And there have been times when I've taken damage in order to allow something else to happen, like having a character act as a stop, as something for Dahl, the Riot Priest, to collide with so that they can keep charging. Like but it's interesting, like I'm interested in like the psychological, like, or the emotional design of like when that feels good versus when it's like, no, I'm not accepting this turn. One wizard has taken a single point of damage and it doesn't feel right. You know what I mean? Like, it's interesting.
It's funny because the way I play it is that I just say to myself, and I have to say this to myself, I have to set this as my agenda for the play session, because otherwise I will just kind of stop trying to play perfectly. But I just sort of say to myself, I'm playing this for the story, right? And so I complete the missions just best I can, and it's fun doing that, right? Because you still get to, I don't worry about the optional objectives, I just kind of play best I can. And I think the game like gives you a nod for doing that, like unlike Into the Breach, which, you know, I think Tom would probably say is quite a lot of influence of that in this game. In that game, the wrapping and the theming of it is such that when you take damage, it feels big, right? I mean, literally big. You're in these hulking mechs and you take damage and it's a big like, oh shit moment. And it means you really fucked up in Into the Breach if you take damage. Whereas in this game, especially because of the sort of rewind function anyway, that like damage is pretty much optional. I think it just gives you a kind of a pat on the back, sort of a little, or maybe a little shove in the small of the back. You're basically being touched on the back in some way. and that just by
back to smacky bum bum.
Back to smacky bum bum time. Yeah, your little pat on the bum to just say, well done. Yeah, you did it. I also appreciate that if you don't complete one of the optional objectives, the mission like wrap up says, did you do this? And it goes, nope. I feel like that is a perfect level of just the mildest bit of passive aggression. It's just on the cusp, rather than like failed or no. It's just nope.
Well, there's also quite an elegant catch-up mechanic in that, because the ones you do have done are kind of done forever. You've got the point for them. So the next time you go back to those ones where you did miss one, you only have to worry about the one you missed. So it's quite an elegant kind of self-balancing thing.
Yeah. All of the optional objectives have to be more fun for me if they're mutually exclusive with knocking every single other person out of a window. And that is, I mean, knocking every single person out of a window is the most fun thing you can do in video games. And that's just like, that's the first thing it gives you.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, knockback generally is completely underutilized as like probably the thing that's fun about fighting Smash Brothers, fighting games, whatever, right? Like, it is inherently more fun than taking damage to be punted, I'll just say it. The other thing I wanted to talk about, actually, is like, and it's from a narrative point of view, again, from a narrative design point of view and plotting, is it's very Tom to build the plot in a way that's highly internally consistent with the way you're told its game mechanics work. You know, not just in terms of having narrative explanations for things like rewinding and so on. I really like, not to spoil the joke, but there's one, you know, the narrative exploration for how you know what the exact situation is in the next room is the Navy Seer can just see it. So he knows, you know, he has a vision of what it looked like to walk through that door, and then just kind of bases on that vision, knows where everyone is. There's one moment in the game where for reasons that ability is switched off, and that character says, well, how do we know what's on the other side of the door? And for that mission and that mission only, the door has a window in it.
That's fantastic.
Which is a great joke. But yeah, the one thing I wanted to really draw attention to is actually moments of drama, because it's very common to kind of want it, the narrative to work with the game systems as well. And there are some of my favorite moments in it, and I think the moments that impress me the most, you know, kind of beyond the kind of mission to mission stuff, are almost like the more kind of like cutscene or story moments where you're asked to use, kind of pay attention to what you know to be true about, from a sort of thematic point of view, a narrative point of view, about the powers you have to kind of solve a narrative problem. There's one of those in particular. It's quite generous with like a hint system if you're really stumped by what it's asking you to do, because it's not obvious. But there's one of those in particular that, because I, you know, I felt very rewarded for having been paying attention in terms of how to solve a very, like a kind of, you know, otherwise an unsolvable problem. And it all hinges on what sounds like a kind of a joke earlier about how one particular power actually works. And that stuff is very satisfying. And I think it's again, you know, we're talking about how, what kind of comedy games are good at. I think that's a kind of storytelling the games are very good at, is again, through making you pay attention to systems and patterns, actually deriving drama and kind of like moments of kind of escalation and sort of like satisfying twists from those same systems is good. I think it's good. That's what I would say. I think I like it. I like it when games do that. Good job, Tom.
Good job, Tom.
Good job, Tom. Do we have any of the concluding statements on tactical breaches? I mean, I was joking when, obviously, when I said, you know, what shit about it, because truly nothing is. But it does, it does feel deeply compromising to this podcast. And not only have we flagrantly discussed a game in which I think, you know, we have clear vested interests, but we have nothing bad to say about it.
Yeah.
Basically, because it's great. So
this really is about ethics in games journalism.
Yeah,
Francis still hosts the podcast files, so we have a vested interest in his success.
Oh, we could have really tested his integrity with this. We've made this incredibly easy for him.
Yeah.
He made it easy for him by spending 7+ grueling years making this game just to make it easy for him not to delete this off his server. That's the moral quandary he has evaded by doing a really good game. Very excited. I mean, you know, I'm excited to kind of imagine what this particular set of fascinations will draw Tom to next. But
yeah, I can't wait to see. I mean, he's had so many other ideas. He's talked about them openly,
yeah,
where he has an idea. And like, I wonder which of those ideas that he's almost been distracted by from this game, which one will survive the bear pit of his next R&D process.
I really appreciate his just dev diaries as well. They're always really good. They're always really interesting, you know, for, you know, someone like me who's just sort of just getting into game dev and things like that. They're just kind of lots of insight. Like, I really like that he talks about problems that are kind of very specific to the project that he's working on, the stuff that he's doing and his perspective on things, because that kind of specificity is often missing from that sort of stuff, from, you know, your man on YouTube doing his tutorial on the whatnot and the what have you. Like, actually the specifics that Tom gets into and the honesty with which he like unpacks how things have gone is just, yeah, really useful, I think.
Should we do some questions from questions?
Yeah, let's do it.
Kane from the Discord. asks. Sorry. Kane from the Discord asked. There was some Discord... Oh, God. Actually, someone else might want to read this because he uses a word in it that I don't know how to pronounce.
Okay. Kane from Discord asks... Some Discord discourse on how Morrowind still holds up as a great game, which I agree with, has me thinking about how games age compared to other media. Television and film is an era of non-stop remakes and remakes of remakes, and we groan whenever a new one is announced. Games, on the other hand, barely see any real remakes. Old games seem much more likely to get sequels or prequels like Deus Ex Human Revolution or spiritual successors like Bioshock than straight-up remakes. And the ones we do get are much more likely to be well-received. Are remakes of games somehow intrinsically more meritorious than remakes of other media? Is there something about games that makes them resist simple recapitulation? Do you think games age better or worse than other media? Kane, with, I think, 15 questions.
He's been storing them up for us in his Kane hive, his Kane hovel.
Yes, no.
Next question. I will say that when I posted this on our episode planning Discord, Graham Smith said, reject the premise of the question and make fun of him for asking it, which I think is always...
a time-honored tradition on this podcast.
Absolutely, yeah.
No. Yeah. Also, you know, shout out to Graham's first contribution to this podcast in the years since he departed. Instructing us to bully the audience and piecing off into the night.
I think they are more meritorious than remakes of other media. Obviously, there are problems of curation in games, and remaking old games gets around that by allowing them to be playable on new platforms. That's the kind of the most basic entry level reason why remaking games is more meritorious than other media. But also, I think there's just a need to reassess games that have fallen out of the limelight. Like I went back and talking of Deus Ex, there I went back and I started playing Deus Ex Mankind Divided again, the not terribly well loved sequel to Human Revolution. I remember it getting sort of slightly lukewarm reaction when it came out, but it's so much better than most other games that have released since then. And only going back to it now has made me kind of realize to what extent it was ahead of its time and how much it did right. And I think that kind of reappraisal just doesn't happen very often unless there is a new release. Like this is just an argument about the business and the marketing and the economics of re-releasing games. Obviously, I've been able to go back and play Mankind Divided again with no real difficulty. But playing it again, I was... really thinking, well, I mean, they should just do a texture pack and re-release it. Like, we don't need necessarily another Deus Ex game. They could just re-release this one for the same full price, and it would be still one of the best games to release in 2024. And all they need to do is up-res a few textures. Or do they even need to do that? I don't know. What do you guys think?
I think it's an interesting one because I'm not sure that sort of... a remake in that sense, like an up-res version. That's the thing I do agree with, because I think for me, where I think a remake is warranted is all to do with accessibility of one kind or another. Either the kind of the preservation of the curation element of making sure a game is still playable, you know, rescuing it from defunct platforms or making sure that some aspect of it can still be re-experienced. That's very valid. And then the other is, I think, about making games more accessible that may have had really great qualities, but be off their time in other regards, right? Like, there's a lot of
System effort. Shock would be System a Shock. Good example.
Yes, right.
Games All of the Night Dive stuff has reappraised their source material in ways which make it more accessible without losing what is the quintessential qualities of those games.
Right.
Unlike unlike the Resident Evil remakes, which are essentially whole new games with the same name as an old game.
Right. And like, yeah, the Resident Evil remakes kind of are, you know, individually good games, but in the sense that they're remakes, they are effectively just the same story. So in a sense, they're kind of asking you to be glad that that story has been preserved. And I don't think that's necessarily the quality being preserved hugely. In other contexts where it's like, yeah, a game that had truly bananas controls because it was 1993 and no one knew how to control a game. No, you'd have to be pretty boring to lament the absence of the change to that particular aspect of it. And almost certainly when that is the base, when that is kind of part of a remake, there is a kind of like pedant's control scheme available to you in the menu where you can kind of experience, you know, control a game with a numpad again. Like,
oh, goody.
Yeah, exactly.
Can't
wait. Cursor up to jump.
Exactly. But I think otherwise, I think like I would, in a purely idealistic sense, I would rather see more new games that were good and sort of fully kind of respected why those games were good rather than the opposite. I guess maybe I'm trying to think. I don't really kind of to be too curmudgeonly a point necessarily. When you point out that like Human Revolution really stands up, part of what you're saying is like we have not had a wealth of games like it in the years since. There are the Dishonoreds, there are, you know, Mankind Divided has its qualities, etc., but it's an underserved genre compared to, and that I guess maybe the way to put it is like in a world of risk averse design, which is true of games as it is for films and TV, what do you kind of are there interesting ways to lower the risk of a project while still producing something that's really high quality? And that's the thing that I would argue is sort of underdone, you know, like to go back to it, Tactical Breach Wizards is a very accessible game, but it doesn't lack those qualities because of, you know, the lens by which accessibility has been achieved does not take away the possibility space. In fact, it opens it up for people to enjoy, which I would guess is the point.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because to compare TV and movies to games, which is a solid comparison to make, I think. Video games are necessarily iterative in ways that movies and television aren't necessarily iterative, right? So with video games, you know, crudely put, Wolfenstein, you know, leads to Doom. Doom leads to Quake. Quake leads to the Dark Side. Quake leads to Half-Life. And you have that kind of sense of people building on top of each other in a way that isn't just that is substantive, right? It's not like these developments are genuine, right? These games build on each other because of the progressive nature of the technology available, and the fact that, like, in the kind of video game, you know, sort of idea space, everyone just kind of draws from what other people have done and builds it into the kind of firmament of the whole, right? So you end up with these genres which are very, very fundamental. Cinema and television, although there is an aspect to that, right? There is a iterative kind of feedback loop between creators. It's not as necessary as it is in video games, right? So you do get technological progress that feeds into, like, with special effects that you're using, and you do get narrative and character and plot things that start to recur, you know, like the amount of movies that have featured a man in his, you know, past the age of 50 going around and beating up people, you know, that is a tech that has been uptaken very enthusiastically, you know, by cinema and kind of built into the tool set. I think video games kind of can't avoid it. And so remakes kind of do sort of fit into that structure. I think part of the problem recently with television and movies, really, really a huge problem, I think, and sort of part of the reason why I now work in video games and not TV, is that that iteration has become too fundamental to the way that these things are made, right? Because they're so risk averse. It's like, let's just make Doom 2, Doom 3, Doom 4, Doom 5, Doom 6. Like, you end up with a kind of relatively shallow idea space to work with, which is just making everything kind of atrophy, which is kind of how I feel about TV and movies generally at the moment, is that they just are the kind of Aurora Boris kind of thing of kind of just slowly going round and round and round in circles. And so, like, with video games, like, it does feel like a more worthwhile endeavor, because video games are by their nature a kind of progressive, iterative kind of harmony between technology and kind of creativity. And so I don't even know what kind of point I'm making with this, just to kind of observe the fact that, like, the idea of remakes, the idea of revisiting something, like, it's kind of, it depends on kind of where you are in your kind of, in that kind of process, I guess.
I think the other really important factor here is, like, both, like, all of the mediums that we've mentioned have a, and part of that risk averse thing as well, have like a deep obsession with IP, right? Like, and often a remake, or in the form of like a remake of a film or something, is one of the many levers that can be pulled in order to make use of an IP that a studio happens to own and feels that they'll make them some money, right? Rather than making a new film of a similar kind to something that's been successful, right? Or trying to do something new. And I do think that, like, a lot of the malaise that will have you wondering of Central Bristol Tesco's midday is to do with the over-leveraging of IP. and that's where I'm less interested, right? Like, I'm not interested in, like, the... Because I do think you see that, right? The remake or the repackaging that is there to kind of drum up or gauge interest in a more substantial or expensive return of a particular property. That's not, I think, that interesting, to be honest. I think it's more interesting to kind of identify a cool game to make and then sort of have it stand on its own 2 feet. Like, I appreciate that, like, that question of, like, would you rather get a new Deus Ex or a... just re-release Human Revolution. I suspect the question is actually a game like Deus Ex, right? The name attachment, the kind of the brand attachment, isn't central to that necessarily. It's the sensibility that it implies.
Yes, although I think there's there are charms to that particular game that go beyond just the genre in which it sits, which is appealing to me. Yes, please make more immersive sims, but also that particular version of Prague is really interesting, and lots of the things that they do in it are worthwhile to say and worth revisiting in their own right, which you wouldn't get if you unless all future immersive sims are set in a cyborg Prague.
I mean, the Deus Ex games are an interesting case study in this one, because they are unusually... they have all aged unusually well. Even the first Deus Ex, I played that for the first time, you know, in the last 3 or 4 years. No mods or anything, just the kind of vanilla version. It's really, really good. Like, really good. And it still feels kind of human revolutionary now. Like, the amount of freedom, the amount of space that you're given to explore, you know, it doesn't need any kind of modding or upscaling or anything like that, really, to feel kind of really, really special. Whereas, you know, lots of the games released in the same year, I doubt, have the same longevity to them. I don't know. I haven't played No One Lives Forever in a while, so...
Is there another question from Kane, or is that all the questions that we had?
There is another question from Kane. I can read this one because it doesn't include two words that I can't pronounce. Which games do you lean forward to get closer to your monitor to play? It's genuinely the shooter equivalent of leaning left and right when cornering in Mario Kart. So this question to me made me think about something that I think is a very real problem that a lot of people suffer from, but it goes unnoticed by society as a whole, and we are the quiet sufferers. of this terrible, terrible affliction, which is resolution anxiety.
Right.
There's a button you can click in games, right? You go into the options menu and you change the resolution settings, right? This is a thing that you need to do sometimes.
Sure.
And then things go small and they're hard to see. And there's no way out of this. There's no way to escape the smallness of the UI in a Paradox 4X game. And so you sit there squinting at the screen, thinking that you're doing something wrong and that the devs of that game are angry with you. So that's my answer, just to basically reveal the very worst of myself.
In that you lean closer because the game doesn't have UI scaling. I think in terms of like having that, you know, sitting up straight kind of thing, it's either competitive things for me traditionally, like competitive shooters, etc. I did have it today. I'm not going to bang on about this game too much, but I've been playing Space Marine 2 in co-op. I think that is 100% how that game is intended to be played, is in co-op and on a hard difficulty setting, because I'm really enjoying it. As someone who really loved, for example, Gears of War as a co-op game, as a kind of fun, fairly breezy way to spend time with friends, and given the extent to which Gears of War always wanted to be Warhammer, it sort of does feel kind of inevitable to kind of come back to this. And that, for me and a friend of pod, Paul Canavan, who we've been playing it together, is very much a game about like leaning in to watch your friend like fucking snatch a little tyrannid out of the air and then stomp on it while going "Oh!" at each other. So yeah, I think it's probably a much lesser experience if you don't embrace the to be seeing and being seen aspect of co-op in that regard. But I think that sort of it has recaptured that feeling of like couch co-op Halo, for example, or pointedly couch co-op Gears of War, where that sort of like slight, I don't know, I think the note here was happy men playing with their big toys is the feeling it gives me, and enjoying it very much. But that genuinely has, I'm not just using this question as an excuse to talk about Space Marine 2. Genuinely, that was the experience today. So that's the one that's top of mind.
Can I use the question as an excuse to talk about Hunt Showdown?
Oh, that's a really good one. Yeah.
Because a recent innovation in Hunt Showdown is that they've introduced farness. Farness, distance, furtherness, away.
Away, yeah.
It's always been a fantastic game. But one of its hallmarks is that the environments that you have previously been in are incredibly dense in a way which usually shuts down lots of sight lines. So even though you have these rifles and whatnot, distance has always been curtailed in Hunt Showdown previously. But now they've got a new engine, they've redone the game in a bunch of other ways and rebalanced it, and they've also introduced a new map which has a huge amount of verticality in it, in ways which open up massive cavernous sight lines across huge parts of the map, and as a result things can be a lot further away when you shoot at them than they have been previously, and they've sort of adapted to that by adding bullet drop. Never been bullet drop previously, and so when they announced bullet drop I was like panicked, because obviously I'm not going to be good at this game anymore. But what they've done is they've set a really generous threshold for bullet drop, so that the weapons act pretty much as they always have, but then after some very distant threshold of distance, then you get the bullet drop, and it's basically just there to sort of nerf the high skill ceiling players a little bit, so you're not always just going to get nailed the second that you walk out of a mine. But in terms of this question, because things are so much further away, and because there are so many atmospheric effects in Hunt, and because you're often in a position where you are essentially reading the landscape in quite a kind of tense, pressurized and static way, listening for the sound of birds rising or bats emerging from a cavern. Bats and awayness.
And cows. Awayitude.
And cows, dying cows that look at you with their rolling, big, beautiful eyes in these desiccated forms as you then axe them in the face. But all of these things inspire me to peer very closely at the screen, because you really are kind of like reading a single pixel as it kind of jitters in distance. You're like, oh, is that the glimmer from a new kind of water lighting effect, or is that a little man who I can shoot ineffectually with my silenced Winfield rifle, which will do no damage at this range?
Tickle his chin very far away. The silenced Winnie, which is the both a gun in Hunt Showdown and something you must regularly do. you've kind of ruined it for me, because I haven't played a ton of Hunt since the new update came out, but I have been playing notably better since they added Bullet Drop. And I was fucking garbage before. And so it's given me what I thought was like, have I been internally compensating for bullet drop this entire time and just firing my fucking gun in the air like a dickhead? That must be why I'm now doing well. What you've suggested with actually kicking in over a certain distance implies instead that I had like two good games. And nothing has changed.
Well, lots of things have been rebalanced. So you might find that some of the weapons, like a lot of the noob weapons before and the short range weapons, are now incredibly punchy up close. And it's to kind of drive up the ability of new players and low skill ceiling players like myself.
Nice. I'm not new. Like 160 hours. No,
exactly. Hundreds and hundreds of hours into the game, and still I can't hit anything with a label.
Feels what a game, though. Yeah,
great. It's just so good.
The new boss is a sort of roaming fireman that first time beat him, just stood in a river. He couldn't do anything. I felt like a king.
Could you describe the roving fireman in more detail, please?
It's a little Bernie boy.
Hero next door.
The hero next door.
No, he's just a big man who's on fire. That's the, and he throws fireballs.
I still haven't seen him. Like every single match in which he has been on the map, I hear kind of like a distant roar as he gets kind of activated, and then like 20 seconds later, it's like, oh, he's dead.
Yeah.
And by the time I get there, it's just, you know, like there's a smoldering pile and nothing to be seen otherwise.
They don't fuck around with their bosses, do they? Like, you say he's a big birdie boy, and I totally get you, and I totally accept that. And I love that for him. But they have a boss in that game which is just a big spider, right? There's no fucking around. It's not like a goat spider or a hawk spider.
It has got a guy in it.
Has it? There's a guy in the spider. And
sometimes it wears festive socks.
Yeah.
There's a guy in the spider.
It's part spider, part guy. You might call him a spider man if you were so willing.
You've got a spider man, a fireman,
bee lady,
crocodile,
Scrappy-Doo is what that character's called.
Yeah.
Bee lady.
Beaky, Mr. Beaks.
Luck be a lady. That's what I call that one.
She's not a boss, though.
No, but not in those terms.
There's that butcher guy, and I think someone should mod Log from Thank Goodness You're Here into it. It chases you around to try and make the biggest pie of them all.
Yeah. There's the assassin, also known as the prick. Just made of beetles. And fucks off and can't set them on fire. And then there's the crocodile. The big crocodile. Big electric crocodile.
Is it electric? Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it is. It rolls around, and it's also electric. Those are the two qualities of the crocodile. You must fight it in the water. There's a lot. The thing I love about Hunt, I think, more than anything else, is the. I think we talked about this plenty, but like the specific vocabulary that forms around like groups. That then when you start playing with someone else, you realize they don't share.
Jeremy Slugs.
Oh, the Leech King.
Oh,
very good.
Sometimes known as Big Daddy.
I've had excellent experiences on Shunt Hoedown
is a rude thing to do at a barn dance.
Absolutely. Where it's like a really good Heart of Darkness Apocalypse Now simulator, because I just get dumped into a match with a really, really crazy person. And I'm not quite sure who is the most danger to me, the other players, the monsters, or the guy I'm with. You know, it's like Dennis Hopper in Apocalypse Now, sort of jabbering in your ear, and that I always find to be a good experience.
Oh, speaking of, I appreciate this is kind of off topic, but today we decided to try out, because Space Marine 2 has both campaign co-op, where there are three Space Marines, and you and your friend, or up to two friends, take over however many of them. And then there's three-player co-op missions that are kind of run parallel with the story mode. And we decided to jump sideways into that secondary co-op mode to kind of keep pace with the story at a particular point, not realizing that it would match us in with a third person. And there is a real specific, there's like a ripcord I pull, both internally and quite literally in a menu in-game, when confronted with someone who wants to chat in, like, comms when I wasn't prepared for this. And in this case, maybe if the vibe is right, potentially, but I logged in, we picked our Space Marine classes and so on, jumped in, and he was waiting next to the Thunderhawk gunship. And he immediately said, like, you know, my username, Chris, change your class. I want to use my special cosmetics. And he was stood there as the same class. And I couldn't see if we weren't allowed to be the same class or just he felt less special because I was the same. And he's like, change it. Hey man, change it. Hey, bro, change it. Change it. Change it. And then I just pulled both me and Paul out of the session. Like, and it was like just a pure nah.
Like, absolutely.
Can't be arsed with this. Play something else. Went back to the single player campaign for two. But yeah. I want to play Hunt now.
We can. That is possible.
It is possible.
Is that the end of the podcast, Jamie?
That
seems like it.
That is the end of the podcast. Yes, me. Yes, me.
Yes, I suppose it is. Time to yoink ourselves out of this hellish matchmaking scenario. If you would like to send us a question for the podcast, I haven't said these words for a while, you can email us at questions@crateandcrowbar.com. I believe there'll be some kind of plan for us to talk about what kind of games we might be talking about next pod. We'll figure that out. Just bear with us as you've borne with us thus far. If you'd like to find more episodes like this, you can find them on our website, createandcrowbar.com. We have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/createandcrowbar for similar. Thank you, as ever, to all of our Patreon backers who have had a four-month reprieve from having to think about any of this. If you'd like to join them, you can find out more about the Patreon at patreon.com/createandcrowbar.
Thanks
for listening, everybody.
Good.
Bon.